we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Abby, it's great to see you. Haven't seen you in person for ages. In fact, it's going to be about 4 or 5 months since the graduation in Lund. Abby is one of my co-students at Lund, the Masters in Human Factors and System Safety. And he's got some really cool stuff to talk about as how does it make sense? Often we focus on the sort of the sharp end workers and how is it that they don't necessarily do what they're supposed to do? And then we start digging into their second stories and we understand all those conflicts. But Abby's going to take us on a slightly different journey. So Abby, tell the people who you are, what you do, and how you got to where you are now, and then we'll move into that first story that we're going to explore.
Yeah, thank you so much, Gareth, for having me. I think it's wonderful to see you. It's been really long. So I am a master mariner. So I've been at sea since 95. I've been at sea till 2012, and after which I took up jobs ashore. I was in training, I was in insurance, and then finally in ship management. And that's when I got sort of interested in the new view safety. Because while I was sailing, safety was all about following procedures, getting compliant, being compliant, or just sort of doing, following whatever procedures are there and whatever you're supposed to do. And when I happened to read Hall Nagel sometime in 2016, 17, 18, and that's when I got interested in this and I realized that there is another way to look at things. And then, I got into rabbit holes, started reading, came across the master's program in Lund, and that's how I ended up at Lund. And that what the whole human factors program does to you is give you a completely different perspective, from the entire 2 decades at sea, and suddenly you see, there's a different way to look at things. So that's what the program has given me. And I find myself, as I'm speaking, what I think is my position is a little unique in the sense that I haven't known of many people in ship management do this, right? So on an everyday basis, as a safety manager, that's my current role. And previously I was in audits. And before that I was a marine superintendent and we were dealing with, everyday firefighting. And now for a sharp end, I mean, I think I was at the sharp end of operations from the shoreside management. And for us to be dealing with firefighting almost every day, and for someone like me who's done that, and to come across and have an academic background, and, I've been lucky enough to get that perspective, right? So I find myself unique in the sense that I've seen what happens on board. I've dealt with what happens at the sharp end ashore in ship management companies. And now I'm a manager handling safety. And I also have this academic background. So it sort of gives me, I think it puts me in a unique perspective because most people who sort of are academically, have an academic background in human factors or system safety, right? And there I see they are regulators or, they're academics themselves, but they've not really done sharpened operations, at least the few people that I know. So I think, that sort of the academic practitioner kind of thing, that conflict, I have a very active conflict in my head looking at, both these sides. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
So that's my background.
Excellent. And I think that's one of the unique pieces about the Lund program is it brings in practitioners, operators into that space, but it also brings in multiple different domains. So actually having a marine engineer, we've got software people, we've got aviation people, we've got healthcare people. I'm doing the diving side. Police, social care. And actually all of those different perspectives, you sit there and go, wow. And that's, one of the things I want to try and bring out in this podcast is that people behave broadly the same way. And what we can try and do is understand the tensions and the conflicts that exist. And often when adverse events occur or surprises occur, we end up with this very simple linear narrative, this first story that gets told. And because people don't have that understanding of what does the background look like, what does the context look like, what are the trade-offs that are constantly occurring, then that's all they know. And that's how they judge the world. So the way that, you know, this podcast runs is we have a first story. So Abby, tell us about your first story and what does that look like from the space you're viewing?
Yeah, Gareth, when you asked me for this podcast and when you told me that, you know, I need to come up with a first story and second story, I was struggling. I was honestly struggling with coming up with something that could connect with everyone and that would actually, get that message of the first story and second story across. Because this is something that for me, for our reading, when we read Friendly Fire, and that's when this came out quite clearly to me, the first story and the second story, where you have the fighter pilot sort of, you know, blamed for their mistake. And then Snook in his book, he's able to bring out the entire sort of spectrum where he goes, maybe I think all the way up to the Cold War. But then all of those factors sort of coming in and playing into that one decision or that one mistake that cost lives. So instead of, looking at the linear way when someone pulled a trigger and killed 23 people, yes, there is a larger story around it. And I was struggling with this, and you know how much I've struggled for my thesis also. So even when I was looking at for my topic, the research question that I was, I was struggling even to come up with something there. But that's when I sort of, heard this story from a colleague, and which I also write in my thesis, about, audits. It's about how things appear to you first, how that may not be what it really is. Now, I had this colleague who narrated the story of his visit on two ships. So there was this one ship where he visited. He was on the bridge. He was observing the navigation on the bridge. And there he found, the officer. So there was a second officer, there was a captain, there was a pilot, and there was a helmsman. So there were four people on the bridge. And on this bridge, the second officer was, he was never looking out. He was always looking down into the logbook and writing. He was just completing his logbook entries and, recording everything. And he ended up with about 4 or 5 pages of records in that, 1 hour of transit. Now, on a very similar ship, just 2 days later, he goes up, the same person, he goes up onto the bridge, observes another bridge. And there he sees that the second officer, he is hardly writing anything in the logbook. He's looking out. He's looking into the radar. He's looking all around. He's giving inputs to the captain. So he's supporting the decision making, of the navigation team, of the bridge team. And, his bell book or his logbook had just half a page. Now, if these two ships were audited about a year later, because you have annual audits, so if these ships were audited about a year later, quite likely that the first ship, where you had about 4 pages of records filled, would be judged to be better.
Yeah.
And the second ship, it would be like, he's not recorded this, he's not recorded that, he's not recorded this. And that would be a deficient audit, right? Mm-hmm. But somehow, if you looked at the actual decision-making and the real navigation that was happening, quite probably the second ship was better. The decision-making was better on the second ship, right? And so for me, audits are something that on ships we need to do, we must do, because the ISM code, the International Safety Management Code, that expects that the audits are the means to verify the effectiveness of the safety management system. Now, when you are having audits to verify the effectiveness of the safety management system, now how those audits are conducted and what those audits come out with become important, because very often it could happen that, whenever there is a major incident or whenever something untoward happens, it's quite likely that the auditors are asked, why could you not find this out in your audits? Why your audits have been safety deficient? You've not been able to point out that this particular incident was going to happen, right? So what use are our audits? So, that's quite likely an expectation that the audits are able to find out where the next incident is. It's about continuous improvement. Now, these audits, they judge the seafarer who is working in what, you might call a VUCA environment. It's complex, it's volatile, it's changing, it's uncertain. And in that environment, they are judged by a safety management system, which is a written document. A written document is static.
So, yeah, it's static. And so it's really an interesting piece is there's the assumption that the quality of the paperwork indicates the quality of safe operations in a dynamic space. And interestingly, you know, just the way that we think about stuff, if there's lots of inputs going in, we've got limited capacity and we prioritize that. And what's interesting here is if you have no adverse outcome occur, so there's no trigger point to shine the light, your measure of safety is the amount of stuff that's written down. And then you could say, so were they lucky or were they good when they were executing that navigation exercise, you know, in close in port or whatever? Well, there's not much written down here, therefore they can't have been safe. But you then sit there and go, well, actually, now they're doing proper safety, operational safety, as opposed to writing stuff down. So, and I think that's probably quite a fairly common first story about auditing and how do organizations prove that things are safe? Or is it create the situation where the presence of paperwork and the presence of bureaucracy indicates that something is safe because it's audited and it's written down? So back to you, Abby. I know there's a lot of stuff in here. There's really good stuff.
Yeah, so when you say that, right, and I'm beginning to think now, auditors, now quite often when you talk about first story, you're talking about the first and second story of the sharpened workers, right? So to say about the seafarers. But there is also a reason why audits are done this way, right? I think so. There is this local rationality, so to say, not just about the seafarers at the sharp end, but also for the auditors, the audit manager, the management. So all of them are working in this ecosystem that expects compliance, that expects records, and that expects that, like you said, right, to prove the quantum of safety, you know, is proportional to the quantum of paperwork. So the better your paperwork, the more your paperwork, the more safe you are, right? But these auditors are quite often asked, like I said earlier, about the safety deficient auditing, right? So how did you not find this out? And as an industry, we've been trying to find faults and fix them, you know, hoping that that's going to improve things, right? In the sense if I go on board as a superintendent for my inspection. So what my duty is that I have a checklist and then I find out what all things are going wrong. And I prepare a report on all those things that are going wrong, right? And the number of things that I find are wrong makes me a better inspector. So that's my local rationality.
You have a measure of success is, look at all of these things that I found. Yes. Does that not drive certain behaviors then? So that people find things.
Yes.
To be found.
So they're all there to be found, right? And if anyone, any seafarer, any experienced master mariner, chief engineer, he goes on board, it's absolutely not difficult for him. He can find 1,000 things that's wrong, right? So the questions that his manager asks him, right? Now, if I come back from a ship and if I say, well, things are good, I've just got these two things that I want to focus on, my manager is going to be unhappy with me. Because what have you done? You've possibly been sitting in your cabin. Have you gone around? How can you come back from the ship and not find anything wrong? Right? So the moment, I think this is something that Oysoro spoke about during our session, where he said the moment a ship leaves the shipyard, till the moment it comes back, I mean, it goes into the graveyard, every single day, there is something that's wrong. A ship is never perfect.
Yeah.
We are all the seafarers are trying to just work and make that, make the ship work. Right?
So it's quite amazing that they fill those gaps and we don't have more accidents than we do, or visible accidents, you know, whatever you define accident to be. So considering the amount of vessels that are sailing around the world and the incompleteness of the system, both the technical equipment, the social side, the cultural side, the whole sort of operational environment, it's quite amazing that humans fill those gaps.
I think as an industry, we think there are no gaps.
Mm.
We think because everything is written down in the procedures. We have regulations, we have procedures, we have checklists, so we've covered everything. So whenever something goes wrong, it's because you've not followed that procedure. It's because you've not used a checklist. So I think what you said is something that as an industry, we don't recognize. We don't recognize because in a background paper that the IMO had published for what is the World Maritime Day, they very specifically speak about the importance of regulations. And they say how regulations are important for safety. So our dependence, when I'm saying our, I'm talking about the industry, our dependence on regulations and thereby more procedures and more paperwork, I think that's not going away. You know, and that's the way I think the industry wants to control safety by regulating more, right? And that is something that I think is a struggle with us. And what you say, and all of this, the new view of safety, the progressive view of safety, human factors, hope, resilience engineering, whatever else you call it, I think our industry has still not dipped its toe in. So there is still a very long way for us to go and understand all of this.
Yeah. Why do you think that? I mean, we've talked, you know, over sort of beers and coffees, the sort of the diverse global dislocated nature of the maritime space, and I think it's you know there's multiple stories there. Once that vessel leaves, there's, you know, this perception that the master is responsible, or that the legal situation, the master is responsible, but doesn't have much control over what goes on. So there's very long screwdrivers that are being placed around the world to control where the master's going, and yet they're supposed to have some level of autonomy and responsibility and accountability. How does that play in with the auditing then? So where does auditing take place? Does it normally take place fairly close to shore so you can move your auditors in and out the boats? Or do they do the long passages to see the sort of the mundane that's out there?
The audits? Okay, there is this requirement to do one audit every year to keep your certificates valid so that you can continue trading. So now there are companies and then there are companies. So there are people who could do that one day audit. So you go on board, you touch the ship, you spend a day there and come back, and you complete your 15 or 30 page checklist, right? And then there are companies that try to put auditors on board, allow them to sail for 4 or 5 days, right? So there is the entire spectrum of quality in the maritime industry. You could have this one ship operator who is just trying to survive, right? I mean, he's just bought that one ship and he's in this market with all these big players and he needs to survive. And when he needs to survive, he's just trying to do that minimum so that, you know, he gets to earn the money. But then there are these very large operators who've established, who know stuff, and, you know, and many of them do allow their auditors to spend some time on board. So they allow the 4 or 5 days of audit. They come on board on one port, sail with the vessel until the next port. That gives them 4 or 5 days. But even this four or five days, Gareth, even when they get this 4 or 5 days, my challenge or my sort of problem with that is, even then you're going in a very normative way where you have a checklist. And then you're ticking off items on the checklist. So there is the requirement to simply observe operations, and like you said, the mundane, just to observe operations and come up with a narrative, a descriptive narrative of, you know, what's happening on board. So that I think is missing in our industry. And I don't know if you will ever. Yeah.
I was going to say, it's really interesting piece there of. What is that narrative that's fed back to the vessel or to the organization? And how much is it tempered? How much is it truly independent? And what if the audit is for compliance versus learning, what's, you know, how do you get better? It should be about continuous improvement as opposed to compliance. So I can see multiple different versions of an auditor's story that get back to their company.
So, Gareth, I mean, see, audits, you know, I mean, I think we would have to go into the definition of what is learning. Now, I think, I know, that's, I think, another long discussion. But for me, The way it is fed back, right, it comes back as a report, a very normative report to the audit manager. And when I say normative report, it means there is this standard and you've deviated from it. And these are the evidences I have for your deviation. So that's the report that comes to the audit manager, who then sort of collects it for the entire or all the shifts for the organization and then feeds that up to the management, right? Now, how does this go back on board? Now, these reports, it goes back on board with the same normative sort of language telling that you have deviated from this. Now, imagine me as someone, a seafarer, reading that report. It's a judgment on my abilities. Yes. It's a judgment on my decision making, where I was trying to get things done for whatever reason, and then I've had to deviate, or I've forgotten, or whatever else. So there is nobody trying to understand what is happening, but there is a very normative sort of judgment being made on my performance. So what do? I cover up. So when I know that an auditor is coming, when I know that I need to prepare for an audit, I cover up. I do my best so that I show everything is, you know, clean, neat, proper. And this is something that also
the world smells of fresh paint.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And this is something I also heard, you know, during my research interviews with seafarers when I was writing my thesis, right? So in fact, all of them, I don't think anybody has said that they don't prepare. Everyone said that they prepare. Some in the level that, of course, that you need to get ready for an audit just because an auditor is coming. But then there were others who said that they change records, or, you know, they hide records, or they create records just so that they can show the auditor that things are okay. So if this be what is being presented to the auditor, if this be what is coming into the report, then how are we learning?
Absolutely. Go on, Abby.
Yeah, sorry. So for me, I think, you know, so long as the industry requires an audit and that audit is mandatory, so which means that I need to complete an audit in a year to keep my safety management certificate and my document of compliance. These are the two certificates that allow a company and a ship to trade. So long as I have to keep them valid, and so long as I need an audit to keep them valid, I will continue to have that audit. And that audit will be as easy or as difficult as I want it to be. And so we're not really learning there. We're finding deficiencies. And this, again, sort of, you know, I think if you look at it from the safety one and safety two perspective, you know, we are looking at what goes wrong.
Yeah.
And even with what goes wrong, we're not really trying to understand the condition that led to what went wrong. We're simply saying that this is written in the procedure and you've not done it.
Yeah.
Right. There were two
bits that I picked up was that they're only measuring deviations from the standard. Do they ever capture innovations from a standard and find out what is being done above and beyond and then feed that back into, I'm going to be sort of naive here and say, into the organizational learning system? Whether or not they have an organizational learning system is a different piece, but that you know, you've just described the context, which is a simple, you know, a box ticking exercise. You don't go looking for the context. But actually, that's where the learning exists. What are the conditions that lead to deviations or modifications, adaptations, workarounds, or whatever? And also, why is it people are innovating? Because there will be innovation in those operations. So there's two bits there that I'm just sort of interested in exploring as to whether or not that's even looked at or looked for.
So there is something we call as best management practice, right? And innovation might fall into that category. But I think there is not much scope for innovation. We can do better of the same thing. So it's not like coming up with a one when there is a zero. It's like, you know, improving the zero, or, you know, it's just doing better of the same thing, right? You know, a better guard, or a better warning, you know. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. So innovation, I think, in our industry, I'm not saying anybody discourages it, but I don't think we have the environment, you know, the ecosystem that encourages innovation, because we are a very patrilineal sort of an industry where everybody tells everyone else what to do. And so when everyone is telling everyone else what to do, that means there is somebody who knows and there is somebody who doesn't know. right? So it's always the person who knows telling the person who doesn't know that this is the way you do things. So when you are telling me this is the way you do things, I am cautious about innovation.
Okay, so the bit then I would say is, if the standard is there and it's not being complied, but the outcome is still being achieved, is that not innovation?
Yes, but that is not an innovation we want, right? We want you to comply with our procedures, right? We want you to comply with our procedures. Why are you innovating when we've told you this is the one right way to do things?
So if there's any sort of innovation like that, it's stamped on because there's this belief that there is only one way to do these things.
I wouldn't go so strongly on only one way, but that only comes up when there are incidents. But otherwise, you don't even come to know, right? So when people innovate, for example, and when I'm taking your definition of innovation, where you're moving away from the procedures and trying to get things done. And if that be innovation, I think that's happening every day.
Yeah.
But there is no way that we are capturing it. But we don't have the resources and the time to do it because we've been told...
Or the interest by the sounds of things.
Yeah, maybe. I can't speak for also, but maybe. But as an industry, maybe not, because everybody is telling us what to do. You know, and somehow, you know, we're just waiting to be told. So honestly, you would have seafarers asking us, show me where it is written, or please write it down so I can do it, right? So the expectation that things be written down so we could do it is quite strong in our industry, mm-hmm. right? And I think this has happened over time in the sense that if you look at the ISM code, that code is not as prescriptive as the safety management systems have turned out to be. That system, the ISM code, it allows innovation, so to say. It's not prescriptive. Mm-hmm. It is asking you for a safety management system. It is asking you to put in place a management system, you know, for continuous improvement, you know, all of that stuff. But the way the industry has sort of adapted the ISM code is possibly a copy-paste from some other industry. And we've been doing that over time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've just got procedures for everything. Right?
So how do the auditors manage that tension then between, I'm guessing they're professionals and they want to see a good job being done. And so now they're caught between this tension between providing a book answer, a compliance focused answer, and sitting there going, how do we improve the system? And I'm reminded of David Marquette's book, Turn the Ship Around. And there's a chapter there about embrace the regulators and actually using those regulators as a source of intelligence to sit there and go, how did they solve that problem? Because I would have thought there are many similar problems that the auditors encounter while they're doing their operations. Be that a one-day program, there's probably not much time to do stuff, but if you've got a 4 or 5 day sailing, there's going to be opportunity to have conversations and where, you know, the question gets, well, how does so-and-so solve that problem? Or it might be that they don't ask that question because that shines a light on a problem that exists.
So see, when you ask what's a good job, right? So I think it's defining that good job that's a problem. I've mm-hmm. had conversations with auditors, right? And when I am speaking, when I'm trying to see if things could be done differently, can we move away from those normative standards? I think auditors are very professional, very well-meaning, you know, very keen on doing a good job. It's difficult for them to imagine doing audits in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
Audits are taught, trained. You know, whenever auditors are trained for the ISO standard or even for ISM standard, it's always against a standard.
Yeah.
And they always look, even when they write their objective evidences, they look for this one statement in the safety management system that's a requirement and then comes up with a deviation from it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very strong. So when auditors are doing a good job, I think in their mind, good job is number of deviations.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, it's a very personal point of view, but I think because I can't speak for auditors, right? But I think even during my again, I'm going back to my research interviews, and even during those interviews when I spoke with the auditors, you know, they were quite clear that their job is to find these deviations. And by finding these deviations, they are fixing the system and they're improving the system, right?
Yeah.
But one other thing that came very clearly to me in the interviews is auditors sort of recognize the amount of workload on the seafarers, and one of the jobs that they take upon themselves, even if that sometimes the company asks them to do it, and sometimes they take it upon themselves, depending on which company you're working for. But as an auditor, you felt the responsibility to teach, to train, mm-hmm. right? To show people. And one of the things that they trained people for was showing them where in the SMS is this written down. So, I mean, that's very well-meaning, because I don't think the intent is bad, but they're still showing them, you see, this is how it is written in the SMS, this is the chapter, and this is how you got to do it.
Yeah.
So that is the training that goes in again. So there again, you have not built the ecosystem to think differently. Right?
Yeah, that's a really, really valid point. So the auditor is asking for compliance without understanding the context. And so they're just saying, follow this, because the codes, the ISM code and the safety management systems can't prescribe or describe all of the context situations that are going to be there. And yet those are the things that the operators have to deal with. And that's where their tensions come between, you know, and the conflicts that exist. And it's those deep stories that could really help the learning, because you sit there and go, given this situation and this standard to achieve X outcome, how are you doing that? And that's where I would say the learning happens, is where you've got a conflict between a standard and a reality, but to produce a safe outcome, safe however you define that, that's where the learning could really be.
We don't
explored.
Go there, Gareth. We don't go there.
Well, no. It's... and again, that's a contextual thing. You know, so last week I was up in Glasgow with a ground handling operational safety team. And one of their sort of presenters said, lead auditor for this airline. I went, no, you're the chief learning officer. And she was like, what? I said, look, you know, if you go around checking audits, you're measuring a compliance. And I'd just done a piece about workers, imagining workers done, and played some sort of really fun games. And I said, look, you know, your goal should be about continuous improvement. But if all you're doing is checking against a standard and you're not looking at the context, how do you get better? And she was like, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. But that requires a mindset shift to say, my job is to keep things safe because I'm going to make sure everybody complies to the standard. But we know that the standard is never gets there. It's people finish that design as we operate.
Yeah, it depends on what you think is continuous improvement. It depends. I mean, there is contextual, right? Because for me, I even have a challenge with continuous improvement. So where do you improve and reach? Where is the infinity? So it's you're muddling through, right? And every single day.
Yeah. So marginal gains, day, tiny little things. But yeah, it is muddling through.
So that's you're just sort of muddling through and you're trying to figure things out. And so for me, even continuous improvement is something that that makes it a little difficult. And instead of even continuous improvement, I think we should just try and understand the context in which people work, right? The challenges that they're facing, the constraints they're facing, the conflicts they're dealing with, and how are they adapting? And there's just so much of tacit knowledge, right? And, you know, it's about tapping into that tacit knowledge. I mean, there's just so much of literature around it. And how do you tap into this tacit knowledge and make it explicit? Now, how do you make this tacit knowledge explicit? How do you understand what's going on in a master's mind or in a bosun's mind or any seafarer's mind, right? So whoever I'm speaking with, am I trying to understand what they were trying to deal with? Or am I simply sitting in judgment and saying that you did not do this and this is why that happened, right?
You didn't do it how I wanted it to be done, because here's the standard that I'm measuring you against, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So that for me is something that we need a shift, right? I mean, and I don't know, because there is even when I was a little upset with the background paper that the IMO came up with, and where they sort of mentioned the very, very strong relevance of regulation, right? So for me, and organizations like the International Maritime Organization that sort of learning from the entire world. And, you know, so if they still feel such strong need for regulations, of course, there is innovation. Of course, there is regulation. But no one's really trying to understand what's happening, right? How are you making that shift? And that shift doesn't come with regulation, right? That shift doesn't come with new technology. So it's that shift in mindset that somehow, as an industry, like I said, we're struggling with, right? And so there are organizations that are making an effort to shift, but somehow that narrative is getting lost, and it's coming back to improving people, and not really improving. And I'm not in any way saying that we should not improve people. We should always continue to make that attempt. That will continue. But as an industry, the focus should shift, in my view, from people to the
Who
environment,
want
the
us? Yeah,
context, yeah, what's around
absolutely.
them. And we cannot understand what is around them and what's influencing them when we stop, unless we stop assuming and judging, right?
And
And
that's really, I'm going to say, unless we stop assuming and judging, and that's again sort of hardwired into us, we have to consciously learn a new set of behaviors, new habits, new rituals that sit there instead of having that emotive, oh, really, to, oh, how did it make sense? Which is really what this is about, is digging into this. And there's a number of exercises that I've run, and I copied one of the ones from Raoul at Lund, just talking about, you provide a simple narrative and you ask people to judge it, and then you tell the second story. And the dissonance that that creates, where people now go, oh, but what's interesting is where I've done that before, when there has been senior leaders, senior officers in the audience. There is still, the final question, is this a system problem or an individual problem? And I still get about 5 to 10% of people say this is an individual problem. And I can pretty much guarantee that it's the senior leaders, managers, officers in the audience that are saying it's an individual problem, because they're so separated away from the context and the conflict and the tensions that exist. And yet, if I went into their operational space, they would also be adapting, working around, and problem solving and innovating, because they can't get their job done as per the standard either. So it's an interesting piece about the perspective we have. So excellent. Abby, thank you for this. The final bit of this is getting sort of some more knowledge out there. For people to look at, be that a paper, an article, or a book, or a blog article, or a video. And so what would you recommend that's been sort of really insightful for you to sit there and go, ah, that shaped my thoughts, and then others could get hold of and develop themselves in that process too.
Yeah, and so for me, something that very strongly resonates and that I feel is quite useful and is simple reading but deep is Humble Inquiry by Edgar Schein. And that is a book that talks, and I think it actually gives you practical, it gives you a practical approach to building relationship, building trust. And sort of fostering open communication, right? And this is the entire thing that we hear about psychological safety and everything else. So I somehow feel that using this book, I mean, reading this book and trying to put it into practice, we could build, we could build relationship trust in the sense that there are fewer blind spots in a complex system. It helps learning. It helps. It would help even, safety management, whatever safety is. And another book was, I think, would be Design of Everyday Things, Don Norman. So that also talks about, for me, how human-centered design, right, or how thoughtful design, how that can reduce errors, how it can make work easy and reduce the chance for mistake. So that's another book, that I'd recommend. Yeah, and YouTube videos, I think there are quite a few of them, but one, I think if we wanted to get into sort of systems thinking and trying to understand that, is that there is a Russell Acuff video. I mean, there are many lectures of his, but there is this one lecture, I mean, there's one long video of his. I could share the link, but it's
Yeah,
about
please. Yeah, that'd be
him
really good. Yeah.
explaining, yeah, it's explaining the systems thinking view, right, and how. Why we are beginning to think about it. And he has got this very simple explanation on systems view and systems, systems thinking. And that, I don't know. There are more. I think I could. There is this. What do I? There's this video of. I think it's MIT. Not sure, but there is this Robert Sapolsky. Mm-hmm. He has this very interesting videos on on biology and cognition and all of that stuff. So I think that also is. I mean, for
Excellent.
Me, it was interesting. So.
Yeah, that's really good. So if you can share those YouTube links, we'll stick them in the show notes.
Yeah,
the Russell Ackoff one, is that the one about building the cars?
Oh, yes.
That's
yes,
a really
yes,
cool
yes,
bit.
Yes,
is, you know,
yes,
great, we've got these brilliant components. Right, now go and build a car.
Make them
Why
work.
Not fit together. Yeah, and so, you know, it's a really powerful piece. It's not enough to focus on the components. It's about focusing on the holistic system, and that requires...
The interaction, the relationship.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Sorry.
No, totally, totally. It's that bit that we need to come up a level and look at, go, what is it that we're talking about? And it's something that Ron Gant talked about in the second episode. We're talking about how is it
Great
that...
Guy, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, garbage operators, garbage drivers, how do they manage that? And what are the tensions that exist? So, Abby, thank you very much. It's brilliant to see you. And... I'm loving all of the stuff you're posting on LinkedIn, which is really cool. So getting it out there, and when you're that unique person like you are, because of the histories and the background, you provide a useful perspective for people, because they sit there and go, oh, well, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. So, Abby, brilliant. Thanks very much. Take care.
Thanks for having me, Gareth. It's a pleasure.